plan. Brian said he would like to add a point to item number five.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
One point the five here was how will I ensure church support for the ministry? One aspect of church support for the ministry, which I feel is particularly important, is a commitment to use the people who have been trained to a satisfactory level. For me, that's a greater level of depth of commitment in terms of the church board or the pastoral staff or however your government works. So a commitment to use suitably qualified trainees. That says something, that they are prepared to use them, and not just... You see, it's like anything. You know, if someone says, do you want a copy of my notes here? Sure. You know, it's something free. It's something that it doesn't cost you anything. And if someone comes along and says, you know, do you want me to put on a training session? Yes, well, certainly. You know, it can't do any harm, can it? So there must be some, you might as well have it. But then to say, well, are you then going to use it and make full beneficial use of this thing, says another level of debt. Well, that's now going to cost me something. I now have a risk and now have a stake in this thing.
Right, okay. So you have are you willing to actually invest people into the hands of these trainees? Okay, you know, ask yourself that one. Okay, let's pop down to number seven. We want to be moving along here so we cover our content for the hour. How will the trainees be selected? And I believe that selection should be done. I don't believe it's something you just put an announcement in the bulletin and say, we're going to have this class on training lay counselors, y'all come. Okay, that doesn't get it. You have some kind of selection procedure that you go through. We tried to develop one. I picked all the brains of the people that I could at the time to find out, you know, what's some good criteria, how do you go about doing it. We came up with a process that we have. Unfortunately, I was not able to get all of this stuff copied. What I can do is, after I talk about it for a minute, I'll send it around. If there is some interest from some of you in picking up a copy of some of this, perhaps you can catch me afterwards. I can get your name and address, and we can send it along to you. But no. Preferably, you probably would want to take a look at it and trash it. That's why we're going to send it around first, Sam. Low commitment level to start with. So what you'll find here is just a procedure that we go through for people to apply. A little cover letter explains it, and then a little application form. And we I'll walk through and tell you roughly what we do. We get a number of things on background on the person. And then we look through their personal testimony, their personal devotional habits, previous experience as a counselor or counselee. We check out their 10 life areas. You recall that from the basic seminar. See if there's any red flags in those areas. We're looking for evidence of God's blessing upon their counseling ministry to date. Do they have something going on? Is there an evidence that God is already using them or desiring to use them? That's an important criteria for us. That'd be one way of talking about spiritual giftedness as well. We have three letters of recommendation that we look for from your spouse, or if you're single, from your closest friend, from a non-Christian friend, and from someone with whom you have worked, either in a job or ministry. We have a recommendation form, and I'm looking for red flags there, particularly from the spouse. For example, I've had occasions where I've had a woman who wants to be in the course. The husband said, no way, Jose. And sorry to say, we had to say we weren't going to go through with that because we weren't going to cause disruption in the marriage for the sake of a training class. We'll let them sort that out, and then we'll talk about it later. But that's how we handled that. So there are a number of things here you can look at. I'll just send this around, and hopefully you can listen with one ear and look with another. Yeah, maybe something like that. Yeah, maybe give a... If you do so, print nicely, neatly, legibly. Give me a good mailing address, that sort of thing, if you would. And we can just send that around with it. Happy to have you look that over. A key thing here, I think, to bear in mind is how to turn down an applicant. That's a toughie. And I think it's going to depend a lot on who the person is. But if you have some criteria established on the front end, you've got something to work from. Now, what we did is, in our procedure, we had them fill out this application form. They also took a Taylor-Johnson temperament analysis. Then we scheduled, and they had to do all these recommendations and all that. When all that material got back, when the application form was in, with all the personal testimony and your reason for wanting to take the class and all this stuff written out, the letters of recommendation, the Taylor Johnson thing turned in. Then we schedule a personal interview. And I had the person come in, sit down with me for an hour, and I walked through the whole thing. And I had, if there was anything in the application form, anything that was written up, anything on the test, recommendation forms, whatever, that raised questions in my mind, I would ask about it. Or maybe just have them explain something further. Occasionally I'd see some red flags, so we'd explore those areas. Okay. When I got all that information in from all the applicants, then I would sit down and a lot of prayer and struggle would go through. We'd go through all that. Then I come to the point where I said, okay, I know I can handle a limited number of people. Like the first class we started, I let everybody know you're all guinea pigs, and we're going to jump in together and try this thing and see how it goes. It took us about 14 months to do it first time out, a little slower than maybe we've done lately. But we jumped in together and did that. But I felt I could only handle a certain number of people. I had to keep it to a small group. And in my own mind, I was thinking about 10. I ended up taking 11, and I think I turned down 3 or something like that out of the first batch that we took on. And there were times where I had to say to the person, or one man that I turned down, I did not feel was spiritually mature enough to be able to handle this yet. I felt he might be more in there for his own issues rather than he was ready to pass on what he could learn to someone else. Tactfully, you have to come out and say that and why and support it. And if you have some objective stuff in front of you, like a Taylor Johnson or something like that, you've got something to work from. It's not just your being a mean old guy, you know. So those kinds of things we had to look at. Yes. The Taylor Johnson temperament analysis. Okay, that is a basically good personality adjustment. If I saw some, real anxiety patterns, real high emotional difficulties, highly subjective, introverted, that sort of thing. Yeah, basics, looking for red flags. Right, and that was probably a mistake. what we tried to do second time around was to loosen things up, try to take on a few more people. I thought we could kind of get things a little bit farther down the line. We took on close to 20 folks, maybe early 20s type of thing. That was just too much to handle. So that's one thing not to do. Don't take on too big a group. Keep it where you can manage it. And important in that whole process, and this is where Brian's class that he did the third time around is he was really able to work out a lab-type situation, which gets us down into the curriculum here a little bit. Maybe I can just briefly outline how we go about what we do, the basic outline of the curriculum. Many ways to go about this whole thing. We felt that we wanted to start with theory and then go to skills. Some training programs start with skills and go to theory. Okay, this is our particular bias. I believe it's more the bias that IBC follows, feeling that you can basically, if you get the right frame of mind and heart, then the skills will come. All the skills in the world without the right character and the right heart aren't going to carry you very far. So that was where we started. And so we tried to begin with theory and move to skills. The way we've started, and which isn't to say that we can't change this at this point, the way we've started, we take people through the effective biblical counseling text. And I've written a little study guide that goes along with that. And we essentially take about 10 or 12 weeks to work through that text chapter by chapter. We're talking like weekly class sessions of an hour to an hour and a half, preferably closer to an hour and a half. No, there's a, I don't have a copy. There's a study guide, Effective Biblical Counseling Study Guide. Yeah, it's Effective Biblical Counseling, a study guide. I have, no. The Gray Manual is... It's a little booklet that I wrote. It's about 25 pages long, is all. Just a series of questions. Yeah, I have some. It's available. I have some. I don't have one. I have them with me. There, Linda's supposed to have some here. She's going to have a book table. I think there should be some here. I don't have one in front of me right now. I don't think I have one. Because Linda has them. I understand. We ship some here, so I hope we're here. But I do have order forms here if you want to pick some of that up when you leave. You can do that. But that was where we started. Then... we try to take people through the IBC manual. Now, that's the gray thing you're talking about. All right. Now, the first class, we didn't have the benefit of those. But we've had the privilege of hosting IBC twice, and we've tried to time our training classes so that we can get IBC to, be there by the time we're ready for it. And that's worked out the second couple of classes. That's fit in. On one occasion, the first time we did this, we took the class through the whole thing, and I kind of spoon-fed them the manual material. That's why it took us so much longer. And then when we were done, we wrapped the whole group up. Just about all of us went down to Scottsdale and took IBC, whammo, in one big week. Yes? Yeah, the whole copyright issue, we couldn't just Xerox manuals off for people and all that. So basically then we would take them through the IBC manual, having them read through the material, do the exercises, a lot of exercises in there. Now simultaneously with all of this, we have a lab going on. And this is the thing that I think is a great improvement over what we've had. We'd had a lab that worked well for the gals in our first class. We kind of didn't follow through with that very well the second class. Our third one, we've been doing that pretty well. And maybe, Brian, you want to say a word about how that is structured in the lab.
I'll stand here.
Oh, absolutely. I'll stand here close so they can. The microphone will pick you up.
Okay.
One of the things that I really felt after going through the first session, which Ken taught, was the fact that we really knew a lot up here. But we didn't have the confidence and the ability to put it into practice. And that was not Ken's fault. That was just a way of deficiency in the way in which we were learning how to do this process. So when it came my turn to teach this, I very much felt that we should, right at the beginning, even though no one knew what on earth the first bit of theory was, right the first week we start doing labs. Purpose. Threefold purpose here of the labs. First of all, to give them a practice as a counselor. There are lots of things about being a counselor that have nothing to do with technique. What does it feel like to sit there in front of someone and not know what to say? That type of thing. Get them used to that feeling of being a responsible person, having someone perhaps depending on them, umming and ahhing, not knowing what to say, the feelings associated with that. Secondly, give them practice as a counselee. Okay, a lot of people have not been counselees. I had never been a counselee. What is it like to be on the other side and have someone ask you these questions and probe into your intimate life? Not only to get the feelings of what it's like, but also to enable them to begin to work on their own material. One of the things we've talked about this week and will be emphasizing more, you need to know yourself and how the IBC material applies to yourself. This is a good way of doing it, having other people practicing and working with you. Thirdly, my other objective was to build up a close-knit, loving, caring, supportive group. A group of people here who knew one another, who could be really open with one another, who are committed to one another. Those were the three main objectives. And as I said, we started right at the beginning. And in order to allow for the fact that they didn't know anything yet, you have to graduate the process. These people we had were the three different churches. We expanded it, not just to our own church, but three different churches. Hardly anyone knew each other. So how do you get these people to be comfortable with one another? How do you give them something to do even though they don't know what to do yet? 3 points here. I like 3 points. Good teaching.
Good preaching.
Three lots of 3 points.
No poems, though.
Okay. Early on, right at the beginning, what we did was 5 minutes each, 5 to 10 minutes each, one-on-one practice counseling. What we did here, not counseling, rather, we did practice learning listening skills. Just got a quick chat on what is involved in listening and attending and all the non-verbal stuff. Reflecting facts and feelings. There was no output from the counselor yet. The counselee was just saying things and the counselor was just reflecting on that. Okay, so you were 6 years old when you moved from so-and-so to so-and-so. A lot of factual type data. So they're beginning to get to know one another. Okay, just on a very easy level. I can share how many brothers and sisters I had without having big trauma about it. That type of thing. As we moved on and learned some more, they began to get used to each other. In the middle, we then moved on to having our groups, by the way, are about 3, 4, 5. That's about the size of these lab groups in number. That's good. We had a one-on-one counseling session. One person will be counselor each week. The other will be counselee. And we'll counsel for 20 to 30 minutes on real stuff now. Obviously, beginning at fairly light levels and later on deeper. Then we would have feedback. Each of the other people, whether it's one or two or three, as observers. We would work on material we've been teaching. I think we've just gone through the session on one of the aspects of volitional circles or something. We'd be particularly looking for volitional circle type stuff and asking behavioral type questions. Okay, so we'd work on that material. So we get feedback from three observers. People would learn to observe both the counselee, now what are you hearing from them, and the counselor. What were good techniques that that person used? Or what were bad techniques? Or what was their body posture like? And their attentiveness and stuff like that. And then we get feedback from both the counselee and the counselor. This is extremely valuable, you know. I don't know how many times you counsel people and then had them tell you how they felt about being counseled. Or whether you talk to your counselee, how you felt about counseling them. But you can get some good feedback about how you come across that way, both as counselee and counselor. And then later on, one of the problems with that was the fact that you'd be in the middle of some, you just start progressing with one person as a counselee, and the next week you go on to another pair of counselees and counselors. And as we got to know each other and got into the deeper stuff, that became a problem. You felt as though you just start talking about some really important issues and that's it. You don't get another chance for another 3 or 4 weeks. Okay, so what we then did was move on to having one counselee for a 3 or 4 week session. So that you as a counselee could get down to some intense counseling, and you could progress from the understanding the problem through clarifying the problem and the behaviors and emotions and stuff like that to working through the solution. And each person would, each counselor, we take turns being counselor, okay, with one counselee. See how that works? So this person will be counselee, this one will counsel them 1 week, this one will counsel them next week, this one will counsel them 3rd, and so on. So you got to be more intense at that level. Those are some of the things we did in terms of practicing lab sessions. That worked very well. One of the most exciting things for me in the whole class was really the lab session, seeing people grow, seeing people open up, interacting with people at that deep level. Just briefly, some of the problems. Commitment crisis. I think you remember some of the encouragement class. When is it appropriately totally open? Total openness in the context of commitment. Okay, so as you get into the deeper and deeper stuff, start sharing this, you have to reaffirm continually the commitment of the group to one another's help. Okay, it's not just, we're not just opening up just for the process and the purpose of doing it. We are committed to one another's mental health, spiritual health, physical health. Problem with timing, 1 hour is never sufficient, but you have to keep to the time. It seems as though you're being cruel and harsh sometimes to cut that thing off. But again, that's practice. You have to do that as a counselor. You have to keep to time quite often. In terms of the observation, sometimes one of the problems is monitoring whether you've got on the counselor's case. You've got 3 or 4 people telling you what a lousy job you did as a counselor. Even that person there has to be counselee next week. You have to watch that. What we deliberately did was have times in which we evaluated the counselor and learning how to do that in a truthful but practical way, a good practice also, and then evaluating the counselee. But not doing more counseling again was a hard thing. How do you evaluate your understanding how you would have dealt with a counseling situation without actually doing it again? Joys, as I said, one of the great joys of the whole class is seeing people grow, working in a worthwhile ministry. Warning, commitment. Lab sessions take a lot of time. We had 8 people in this class, 2 lab sessions. That was Sunday morning class and 2 1-hour practice sessions during the week. At some time or other during the year, I counsel with each one of those persons, apart from perhaps one or 2. So as those problems arise, they'll want to see you and say, you know, this is the right arisen, some things I didn't know were there, some things that come to the surface I didn't know were there. What are you going to do with that? That's again another time for me. Leadership here boils down to your own vulnerability again. The depth of the growth that the group goes to is proportionate to the depth of which you're going to be vulnerable. I made a point of being one of the group right at the beginning and telling them that I was going to be one of the group. I am going to be counseled. I am going to be a counselee. You guys are going to criticize me as a counselor. You guys are going to counsel me. Now, that's scary to them. It's scary to me. Things really started getting deep and we moved to a different level when they saw me cry, basically. When they saw me cry, we started moving. And so the tone that you set in the groups is vitally important. Really hard to emphasize that. That really is important. If you're just being there, the professional, teaching them how to do it properly, just forget that.
Good. Thank you, Brian. Excellent. Yes?
I'm just kind of curious. After these people went through They only one lab session.
How long?
About a year.
After that, what became of these people? What was their new role? And in addition to that, did they now have a paid position?
No paid position.
No paid position.
Roles go back to what I said first, and what Ken said about our philosophy of ministry. These, like the gal is working with the athletes and so on, it's really an extension of a current ministry or a desire to move into a ministry, a healthy ministry or preventive ministry of some sort. As I say, we moved away perhaps from saying, you know, you are now a qualified counselor and get referrals. Although there's some of that occurring, most of these people are now using or are in the process of using that in whatever ministry they were doing before, other ministries they're moving into.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could run down and one is involved in university ministry with students.
One's a teacher at a public school.
Yeah, you know. They are all available, say, what if you felt?
Yeah.
If somebody came to you and said, well, I'd like to be called to someone.
Sure.
That's basically how it's channeled.
Yeah, we have to work out the schedule and compatibility and all that. But yeah, sure. Yeah.
Can they tell you how many hours you're available? Or
we haven't gone that far.
Oh, okay.
We've considered that, but we haven't gone that formal. It's kind of on call type basis. Right. Yes, I'm aware. You know, that kind of thing is being done. Let me need to slide along here. I'm kind of watching our time. A few more things I'd like to say about curriculum before we leave this subject. I do have a little bibliography that I'll just start around here. This is two different colors of paper, but it's all the same thing. And you can look this over yourselves. But I wanted to mention the encouragement course. It's been kind of funny, but I find that a lot of people that go to IBC aren't even aware that the encouragement videos exist. Yeah. Okay. Well, I've got the information on this sheet, and for no other reason, I thought you might at least like to have it for that purpose. Okay. About what they are. They're 13 half-hour lectures on video. You get it from Columbia Bible College. There's a manual that goes with it to help you go through this stuff. We offer that as a Sunday school class, or sometimes we've offered it on a Sunday night as an elective type course. That's an excellent foundational study, and that serves as kind of the entry level to those who want to go on to this our people class. So if we find people that go through this encouragement course that say, hey, I want more, we say, okay, this is the thing to consider. Give them the application, let them know when our next course will be offered, and we kind of go from there. So this is kind of a grassroots, y'all come kind of class. And that's item 2 on your bibliography that's coming around to you. The study guide that I mentioned here, I have some order forms I can give you before you go. A few other additional items that we found helpful are listed at the bottom of the page and then over on the second side, and I won't say any more about them in view of time, but you're welcome to ask me further about them if you'd like. Hello. Why don't we move down to number 8, rather 9. Change sheets here. What teaching methods, maybe just a brief comment about those. We've already indicated a little bit. Obviously, we're going to be doing some lecture, some discussion, some practice role-playing, some actual lab situations. We require written homework. Each week they had something to do to prepare for the following week, if nothing else, just working through the questions in the manuals or the study guide. We also required memory verses on a weekly basis that related to the study that we were doing. And we had a weekly quiz. They were accountable for the memory verse. They were accountable for having personal quiet time in Scripture and prayer. Now, I don't want that to sound legalistic, but we felt that they needed to be maintaining their walk with God. And that was just one way of finding out. We would ask them, how many days out of the last 7 have you had personal time with the Lord? And then share something that you got from that time. And that was basically 2 questions that we would try to ask each week. And that was our way of trying to keep some level of accountability of that whole thing, to emphasize the importance of our walk with the Lord. practical skills, as we said, are largely dealt with in the lab sessions. Other tools you can be using are audio and video tape. We experiment with these a little bit, but they are very time intensive. And that's part of the reason why we haven't done more with it. There's also the problem of confidentiality and it's particularly in any setting, and then you see how we've tried to structure that here. But even in a church setting, you're looking at it, I think, in much more strong ways. Here you can say, well, you know, only 9 people knew the couple that were watching. Well, that won't be the case in the local church, so how are you going to do that, you know? So we've done a little bit of that kind of thing. Mostly we've used it in role-playing situations or counseling right in class when we've actually tried it out. Can be a very effective tool. There are also some packaged materials out now that use some videotape things. I have an article in the IBC Perspective that you may have seen. This is a couple years back. And in the footnote, there's a little mention of innovations in learning. And you can look that up if you want to get the address for that. I didn't think to bring it along. Okay, so that's just a word about teaching methods. I think number 10 on evaluating effectiveness, we've pretty well touched on this already. That is to say, it's a difficult thing to do. And again, we don't have ways of quantifying that. I believe, though, we need to be thinking about evaluation. I'm strong on evaluation, at least philosophically speaking, but how you go about doing it in a situation like this is not all that clear to me. So it'd be well for you to be thinking through what are the criteria by which we're going to evaluate this program or ministry that we're going to be involved in, and how are we going to tell? You know, and you and whoever's supervising you, if it's your governing board or your pastor or whoever, those things need to be agreed upon because they have a way of talking about our expectations. And if your board is expecting you to turn out 10 elders and deacons at the end of a year, and all you're after is 10 people who have fairly healthy lives, one will say it's a success and the other will say it's a failure. And what's the consequences of that? Well, we need to be thinking along those lines, clarifying our objectives. That goes back to our initial goals and all that. We did do a little survey of our trainees in our class before we came to the seminar. I got some feedback from them. I can't go through all of that. Maybe, Johnny, if you want to, you could maybe say a word at this point, if you'd like, about the effectiveness of the training or lack thereof in your own life. If you want to think about that a minute, I'll give you a chance. So you can talk later. But
I wrote it so well.
You wrote it so well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about it. That's fine. That's good. I appreciate you sharing a little bit. It just might have some impact in your own life. Good, good. Excellent. Thanks, Johnny. Yes?
One of the things that we did in the first phase of training these officers was to get them to write out a paper dealing with the current issue of home life, working it through the four circles, and moving them on to the second level was contingent on whether or not we felt they had an effective job of at least becoming the people who don't cross. If they hadn't, that was one of the ways to be somewhat subjective.
Good. Okay. That's why. Good. Okay. Let's see. Let's punch down to supervision. Number 11. Keep those things circulating back there. Okay, great. How will they be supervised is an important question and supported. Again, this has a lot to do with your goal in training your counselors. If you have in mind a clinical model, you're probably talking a lot more supervision than you are if you're talking a deployment model. Okay? And there's probably something in between there. So you need to be thinking that. Confidentiality is a big issue. Liability is a big issue to consider in all this. I would think probably one of the most the largest single shortcoming of our program has been the limited supervision that our people have received. I would say that if I were just look at shortcomings, that's probably the one I'd list as one of the top. We're working that through. So I'm not going to stand up here and tell you all that there is to how hope about doing that, but there are a lot of ways to accomplish it. There's ways we've worked at it. We've done it by just checking in monthly with each other, one-to-one. We've had some small group type accountability. I've done counseling situations. I'm telling people at the break here where if I'm counseling an individual and I want to have one of our trainees involved, I've had them come alongside, be the third person in the room and watch me work with the person and then maybe pull them into the process, maybe turn them loose to a degree. Every other week or every third week I'll meet with the two of them. It's been various kinds of ways that we've done that, and that has built in some supervision, some accountability to the process. So there are lots of ways you can structure that. I've done taping occasionally, but that takes, again, a lot of time to sit down and listen to someone's tape and then go through it with them. They do that in the program that Larry has at Grace. I took the supervision seminar 3 years ago for a week and went through all of that process. That's very healthy because the intern that I had, Dave Abraham, was good at bringing out, you know, what's happening inside of you when he did this or didn't do that. And, you know, you get into all that sort of thing. That's just excellent excellent stuff because it really gets you in touch with what's going on below the surface of your iceberg there. So strongly encourage that. Let's see. Down to 12. How will we decide when and where we will refer people we can't help? You need to look for some criteria for referral. Know your own limitations. Hey, I'm not expert at handling this, that, or the other. Okay. Know, again, some of your own pull. If you have a hang-up with a certain type of person or a certain type of problem, and that punches your buttons and gets things going inside of you, and you haven't resolved those, then you better be aware of that and not subject a counselee to your hang-up. Get them referred out somewhere else that can take care of that particular need. So be alert to those things. When you've given it all you've got and there's nothing else you've got to give, when there's evidence that progress is not forthcoming, time to reevaluate. Where do we go from here? Maybe someone else can come alongside and help. Maybe the person's not ready to progress at this point. You just don't know. But developing some criteria for referral, those are some of the things you need to think through. And then you also want to know what other counseling resources are there in our area. So if someone calls in, and I don't have the expertise, I don't have the time, or the person is maybe lower on my priority list of folks that I will be willing to accept, what do I do? Where do I point them? A lot of times people aren't aware of what resources there are in the community. You can be a referral source, an information source to help them out. So that may mean you've got to spend some time getting acquainted with some people. You go over and have lunch with so-and-so and find out where, you know, talk philosophy, talk approach, talk skills, talk strengths and weaknesses. all of that. And if you do make a referral, follow it up, find out how it went. Get some feedback. You know, if you send one of your body members over to, you know, Joe Doakes for counseling, check with him a few weeks later. What's happening? How's it going? Are you happy? Any issue? And then file that one away, because the next time somebody comes through that has a similar kind of issue and you know that went well, great. If you know it didn't go well, well, don't send somebody else over there. So, you know, kind of build your data bank that way. In our particular town, we have some hard times with that because we're a town of about 40,000. That includes about 15,000 students. And there's very few resources in the community. So most Christian counseling is either done by pastors or you're talking about referring them out an hour's drive away to Salem or Eugene. And then you'll find a variety of philosophies operating at the two counseling agencies that are in those larger towns. Well, you know, that means I've got to get to know those folks and know who does what over there and who we can live with and who we can't and that sort of thing. So we have, in our area, being somewhat more limited, perhaps more limited resources than perhaps you might have in a larger city like Los Angeles or Denver or Seattle or wherever. Okay. Maybe the final point. Ask yourself, how can we share what we've learned with other people in churches? When I first started trying to learn what was involved in training lay counselors, I got a hold of Dan, I got a hold of Wes Roberts, and maybe one or two other people that I was aware of. I just wasn't aware of folks that were doing this kind of thing in training in local churches. You know, great to have the opportunity that you have here. You know, there are, you know, a couple dozen people at least in this room who are doing it in some way or other. Well, pick each other's brains, you know, and learn all you can from each other. Be willing to share what you're learning, because you may think something is very insignificant in your learning experience, but might be just the thing that someone else needs to know. And several of the points that I picked up saved me from some grave errors. Not that I didn't make a few others, but spared me a lot of grief to have picked up just a couple of key points. And so you may not think you have a whole lot to offer, but you might be surprised. And so I just encourage you to think about passing it on. Learn and share. I think this is a good scriptural principle to be discipling each other, passing each other along. I mean, this kind of input. And you need to be thinking, are you open to training people from other churches? We've just tried that now in the last year. We were able to develop some cooperative relationships with a couple of other churches. That went well. That was a lot of fun. Are you open to that? Is your church open to that? Are they open to you doing that? You know, lots of kinds of things. I think there could be some beautiful cooperation in the body of Christ if we're able to do that together. Okay, we're coming down towards the end here. Brian, in the top of my briefcase there are those order forms. We could send those around. Is the application form making its way around bit by bit? Okay, good. Well, let's keep it going. Okay, we've got a few more minutes. Maybe some questions we want to come back to or other things?
I wanted to hear from a few people here who have lay counseling organizations. I belong to a very large church where they have a large lay counseling organization, and the lay counselees are very frustrated because those who come for counsel are not being accountable for their counseling. They don't show up. They don't do their homework. Of course, there's no fees involved. And the lay counselors are very frustrated. You know, they're defeated about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to apply everything that they've been trained to do. And the counselors won't permit that because of their lackadaisical attitude. What do you do about that? What are other people?
Well, let's interact on that one a little bit, because I can't really speak to that from my personal experience, so maybe some of the rest of you can. Yes, in the back there. No?
We could share that by in our statement of responsibility, if folks that they're looking forward and they would be accountable as to the counselor's discretion as to how they did it or not.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So don't. If you miss it twice, $20 to get back in. Okay, there's a little teeth in it. All right, for accountability. All right, good. Bob?
I also put that in my house. I'm not sure if you
right. Carry on. Okay. Thanks for sharing your thought. Good. All right. So that idea of making it clear up front what's expected of the counselee is another good way of building that in. Following through on that, though, means you got to put teeth in it and do it when the time comes. Okay. Yeah. Pardon? All right. We have an example of charging a fee to everyone up here. So if you don't show, if you miss an appointment, you still pay a fee? If you cancel out and just don't show or something?
No, at that point, it hasn't been agreed upon. You charge a fee enough that it just, it really is an indicator of their commitment to the process that's going on.
Okay.
If you don't charge money to maintain, to increase revenue to church council, the fees have to do with treatment. They don't have anything to do with maintenance.
Right.
I don't care if people pay $5. You know, if they have to give us something of value, they will value the council what they do.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot to be discussed about that particular point, whether or not to charge fees. And we could go into a long discussion on that one. But some of the real pros and cons, and not to mention the liabilities and legalities and where you're at. But that's an issue to consider. Will we charge fees or not, and why? What's your philosophy on that? That's a one we could talk about. Is it Ruth? Ruth?
Rosemary.
As I recall, help me out, but I think you had a rather interesting way of viewing the fee thing. Help me remember that.
By donation.
Right.
And we do accept a suggested donation schedule, but we that's on our statement also. And it's a nice note that it's strictly between them and the board, and we rely on God to provide the resources for people. And in other words, we try to stretch the
there's no billing statements or anything like that, right?
No, we give them a envelope that they can place their donation in, and you can handle it one of three ways. Either with the business counselor or during our work service, you can put it in the offering, or you can put a stamp on it and leave it in. Nobody's ever going to pick up on it, but it's a new
show. Yeah. So that's kind of a little more of a hybrid blend. It was interesting when we talked about that a year or two back.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't really ascertained that to our satisfaction yet, because the business goes directly to the business office, and the business office doesn't break it down. But the kind of a educated guess, I guess you might say, we feel that we're getting probably about $5 an hour. The biggest percentage of ours are
Yeah. So $5 an hour without financial aid is pretty good. Yeah. Right. Okay. Good. Any other comments, questions? Yes.
In light of your philosophy of benefits, at what point do you want to see the counseling skills and just the whole impact of the counseling model impacting the individual within the counseling? What point do you want to see that integrated throughout the life of the church? And really what I'm asking you is, your counseling ministry is locked in the eyes of the church. Is your counseling ministry as important as some or is this another ministry that's added on that you feel called at times, you know, that it's just kind of an option, not really prepared?
If I were to, all right, in other words, you're saying, how does the church at large view counseling? Okay, in terms of its priorities. That's two different questions, I think. Maybe help me understand it again.
What I want to know is, from the church's standpoint, counseling ministry, is that just another unique option, alternative ministry, or is that as fundamental as most traditional churches say Sunday school? You can't dismantle Sunday school. I can't answer about that.
All right.
So is your counseling ministry becoming that important, that pervasive?
No. I say as far as the church is concerned, no, that's not the case. They would see it as more of an option, and probably a lower priority option. We did a survey of our staff and elders and had them rank order about 20 different things. And as I recall, I can't remember the exact number, but I know counseling ranked in the lower half of that.
Would you like to see a
in a counseling ministry, you mean directly?
As opposed to other things.
No, what I would like to do is I would like to equip, because I see this as a discipling process. Okay, I would like to equip people, as many as I could, with the kinds of insights about themselves, about the Lord, about people, how to work with them effectively, and then turn them loose in whatever other area of ministry they choose to be involved in, because I think they'll be that much more effective having gone through this thing. So that's the way I would see it operating. So I know I'm not trying to carve off a chunk of folks who are going to be specialized over here. I'd rather see it diffuse throughout the whole body and infect the whole life of the fellowship. That's where I would come from. Yes? Perhaps that's a factor. I'm not sure it's the whole matter by any means. But there you're dealing with, again, philosophy of ministry issues, you know, program orientation versus relationship orientation and all that.
This one is a lot tougher in a sense, because you don't have a lot to show for it. And you know, can you exist in a ministry which is just out there and permeating things and is not a visible, you know, ministry life or something? You know, can you? Are you happy for your own self-fulfillment viewpoint to put out now in the time of life and not see any fruits of it just like that?
And that just a hitchhike on that thing. That's an issue I had to work out, because I can't stand up in a board meeting or something or in front of the church and say, describe all the people that I've seen that week or the previous month and all the stories that I know about every one of them, you know, so forth and so on, because you don't even let people know that you're seeing so and so and then so forth and so on, okay? But I can stand up there and speak or be involved in a class or something like that, and I know a whole lot about a whole bunch of people in that fellowship, and that characterizes the way I relate to them, the way I relate in my preaching ministry and all that. I recall one of our, we had a volunteer bookkeeper that came in for a while to kind of pinch hit for someone, and her office happened to be in a position where she would see the people that I took into my office. And after seeing me operate for a few weeks, she came and she said, "I had no idea, you know." And I'm thankful she didn't, because it wasn't something, you know, but it really opened her eyes up to see that, hey, there's a lot more going on here than I had any clue about. Well, I don't have the privilege of sitting everybody down in the body in that particular position for a week's time and let them come up with that sort of thing. But you have to be content with that. And when someone else has got this big program going on and you're over here kind of plugging it away in the trenches with some folks, not to think like, well, you know, because he's getting all the flashy, applause. So where your heart is, you know, your motivation for ministry becomes very critical at that point.
Dan, yeah. You took your counseling ministry, right? Your lay counseling ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Split it out of the church, moved it one block down.
Uh-huh.
Same people, same training, same everything, and disassociated it with the church. Became a private Christian counseling ministry. Okay.
Yeah.
Would you develop another one in your church with that organization being there?
Well, I guess I would probably disagree with your initial premise. I wouldn't do that. Okay.
Well, let's assume there was that organization, and you understood how they were trained and
mm-hmm.
who they were and so forth. But they were a private ministry down the block.
Uh-huh.
Would you still be involved in the council?
Probably, but I would probably have some kind of cooperative relationship, assuming, again, we had common philosophies and all that. I might lean on them a little more. Yeah. Sam, you want to...
That's the situation that you have in Southern California. Norm Wright within some folks in the church, and he's not the only one. There's several good Christian counselors in one kind of area that I don't refer to, because they're on the bottom of the stack of cards that I am. And we still have a lay counselor in the ministry, but the idea is, once again, facts. I want to raise the level of consciousness of people in my church, where they're conscious of the needs of people and conscious of the approaches that they should use to engage people. By body functions for three or two counselors.
Grace folks been through that. Folks, I'm mindful of time. We're about 5 minutes over. I don't want to cut anybody off, but I'll be happy to stay up here for a little bit if you want to chat a little further. Why don't we just dismiss in prayer, shall we? Father, we're thankful that we've had this time together. Lord, we just again lay it before you with the sincere desire that you would sift out the wheat from the chaff and allow that which is really of you, that is designed by you to bear fruit, to take root within us, to bear fruit in our own lives, to bear fruit in the lives of those with whom we minister. Pray that you'll blow away that which is not of you, that you'll sift us out, Lord, and cause us to be even more effective for you. Thank you for the joy that's been ours in having this time together. In Christ's name.